listening to All Things Cage at Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM, Radio for Open Ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Emeritus Director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is musicologist and composer Martin Idden, Professor of Music and Aesthetics at the University of Leeds. Idden has authored several books that take center place in the library of the John Cage Trust, New Music at Darmstadt, Nono, Stockhausen, Cage, and Boulez from 2013, John Cage and David Tudor, Correspondence on Interpretation and Performance, also 2013, and John Cage and Peter Yates, Correspondence on Music Criticism and Aesthetics from 2020, all published by Cambridge University Press. Of the three, I most appreciate Idden's The Music of Darmstadt because I learned the most from it. But I'm at the same time partial to books that rely upon letters and correspondence, like the much earlier Boulez-Cage correspondence, edited by Jean-Jacques Nattier and published by Cambridge University Press in 1991. Idden's second and third books grew out of archived correspondence. The second between Cage and David Tudor, Northwestern University's archives, and the third between Cage and Peter Yates, Mandeville Library, University of California at San Diego. Tudor is well known in Cage circles as a brilliant pianist and an early champion of Cage's music, who would in time become an extremely important composer of live electronic music with the Merce Cunningham Dance Company. The lesser known Peter Yates, founder with his wife, Frances Mullen Yates, of an important concert series in Los Angeles known as Evenings on the Roof, later renamed Monday Evening Concerts, was an important contributing writer on music to Arts and Architecture magazine. In 1968, Yates would be appointed chair of the music department at Buffalo State College, 4 years into the promising start of its Center of the Creative and Performing Arts at SUNY Buffalo. For an invaluable read on the subject of the center, see Renee Levine Packer's This Life of Sounds, Evenings for New Music in Buffalo, published by Oxford University Press in 2010. Boulez, Tudor, and Yates, a triumvirate roster of correspondence of great importance to the development of John Cage as he came to be John Cage. As I observed in my preface to the Selected Letters of John Cage, Wesleyan University Press, 2016, by his late 30s, Cage's writing with ease and fluency to his intellectual peers, Pierre Boulez and David Tudor on technical matters of composition, and Peter Yates on matters of aesthetics, music history, and style. I was especially pleased to see Idden take up the cause of Peter Yates and John Cage, being the lesser-known duo among the couplings, and to produce such an engaging book about the letters and ideas that passed between them. While only prematurely germane to the present program, it's important to note here that Idden is also co-author with Philip Thomas, professor of performance at the University of Huddersfield, where he's active with the celebrated ensemble known as Apartment House, of Cage's Concert for Piano and Orchestra, Oxford University Press, 2020. This book lives alongside a brilliant interactive website, see cageconcert.org, developed with the assistance of Emily Payne, an associate professor of music at the University of Leeds, whose work bridges musicology and psychology by focusing on the musician's experiences of performance, often in contemporary concert and experimental music. This interactive website includes films and apps that enable and encourage deep exploration of the performance possibilities in Cage's seminal 1958 work. The Concerto for Piano and Orchestra is unique in Cage's catalog, comprising as it does 63 pages to be played in whole or in part in any sequence and involving 84 types of composition, much of it graphic. It is, as you might imagine, not only unendingly flexible as to its orchestration and content, but also well known for its visual beauty. Given the importance of this work, we'll devote our next program for All Things Cage to conversation focused entirely on it and to conversation around Iden and Thomas's marvelous book about it. Iden and I will then be happily joined in conversation by Emily Payne, who was essential to the development of the book's interactive website. This dedicated Part 2 program is currently slated to air on New Year's Eve, December 31, 2025. So welcome to All Things Cage, Martin. It's great to see you.
Yeah, it's lovely to be here.
Good. How's your weather in Leeds? Are you as warm as we are?
I'm not in Leeds. I'm just up the road in York, and it has been about as warm as you are. And suddenly, bizarrely, it's clouded over, and it turns out not to be in a bad way, actually. I mean, it was horrifically hot earlier, and now it's not muggy somehow, and there's a bit of a breeze. It's surprisingly nice.
It sounds just like here,
yeah.
Which is to say, confusing.
Yes, that's true.
Anyway, it's great to see you. And I'm so glad we're doing this at long last. You probably would have no way of knowing because my life has been so much, not my own, for the last couple of years. But I'm a huge fan of your work. Huge. And I can't, you know, I would only fault you by saying that any book that you've written that I read is so engrossing, I'm constantly pulled in seven different directions while reading it. So if I go to look up something in particular, you got to give me 2 hours to do that because it'll take me that long to get back to it.
Oh, well, that's very kind. I mean, I'm glad. And honestly, I mean, you know this yourself from doing the letters. The only reason you really do most of it is in the hope of having readers who find that sort of engagement with
right.
it.
No, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. Yours are so, I mean, thank you. I love doing the letters and I've gotten a lot of nice feedback on them, but yours are so much more expanded. You take the opportunity of correspondence to really dive in, do deep diving into contacts, relationships, you know, the importance of X, Y, and Z. I do that, but to a much smaller extent than you do. And I just think they're wonderful. The Yeats in particular, when you decided to do this book, and for our listening audience, let's go over really who you are and what you've done. So Martin is the author of really three books that we're going to be speaking about that I guess combined with the letters in a sense, but also combined with the Jean-Jacques Nattier book on Boulez and Cage's letters. These are all books that emanate in and around letters that have survived between Cage and extremely important people in his life as he went along that really, I think, in many ways, it's not too much to say that they really helped him develop as a thinker and as a composer just by being able to express himself.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about confessing this, but maybe I should confess it. For a long time, I think I was a bit wary of Cage in all sorts of ways. And I guess what I was wary of was the way in which lots of people seemed to have these particular ideas about him that put him on a pedestal in all sorts of ways. And there's that rather nice essay by Carl Gann, I think, about Cage as a father figure. And it often felt that people wanted Cage to be his public image, and they found that a really useful corrective to all sorts of stuff that people find in contemporary music, perhaps about the sort of phallic masculinity, if that's not too exaggerated a way of putting it, of composers, that it must be this way and all of this, and that aspect of Cage, I know it appealed to lots of people, and it wasn't that was the problem, but it was the appeal of Cage that was the problem. And forever I kind of like, I just want to hold Cage at arm's length because I don't want to be seduced by this. And it was reading the correspondence at Northwestern. There's a point quite late on in the correspondence when something goes horribly wrong with the publication of one of the books. I think. And I forget the details really, but I remember that Cage writes this sequence of increasingly angry letters that end up in absolute fury about this and says something to the effect of, fine, this is terrible. You are going to pulp the entire print run and I am going to pay for it. And then we're going to fit. And it's just full of fury. And at that point I thought, John, I think you and I might get along.
That's right. That's right. You won me over.
Yeah, exactly. It's just the point at which I kind of went, oh no, there's another Cage as well. And I find it in the letters. And especially there's a sort of unguardedness in the letters that there isn't in the public persona that I think was really, really carefully crafted to be. This is in part the idea of who Cage thinks a composer ought to be in public. And
Right.
there is a bit of a private Cage who I found myself much more engaged by and much more excited about and wanting to spend time with.
Sure. It's interesting because I think I feel both ways about it, in the sense that when I got to know him, he was, in fact, all that wondrous stuff that people held him to be, and that it was legitimate. He really was that way, but that didn't preclude his losing his temper, being angry with people. I can't tell you how many times he came home from a concert that he attended and just complained for an hour to Merce or anybody who would listen about how much he hated it. He definitely had strong ideas about what good performance was. Not only about his own works, but I think other people's works. He wanted people to take their lives seriously and their work seriously. So he held everybody to a very high standard, which he also held himself to. So I guess I'm just saying that that glorified look at him, or that image of him, partly was true, but that didn't preclude all the rest of it,
Yeah, and I think for me, it was that way in to start to feel comfortable with that other part of him as well. It's also that idea of Cage that I don't know how prevalent this is, but it feels like the one that I grew up with inclines towards a dilettante, a charlatan, a con man doing this in this easy way. And when you get inside, you kind of go, absolutely not. There's a reason why Boulez and Stockhausen, when they met Cage, I think recognized him as being one of their own, if different. And part of that was the rigor and the seriousness and the fastidiousness of the work. And when you go and look at the sketch materials, you see the degree to which Cage may leave certain things to chance or may hand certain decisions over to performers. But the ways in which those things that are handed over are framed so carefully with such thoughtfulness, with such work to ensure that anything that a performer might do is going to successfully realize the piece.
Yeah, I think that's true. I'm thinking about that letter that he wrote. I think it's, I wish I could pull this just like that and tell you the date, but it was to Yeats. It was one of Cage's letters to Yeats. And it was the one that's really lengthy. And he's teaching Yeats why Satie was so important, at least important to him. And it's such a beautiful letter, and it also speaks to Cage's understanding of Western musicology, of Western music, of notation in general, rhythm, all of that, all of the things that we all went through in music school. He was long, long, long learned on those subjects. So that I suppose I always thought that when he said something goofy or flippant or silly or dismissive or whatever I might have thought it was, it came out of such knowledge and understanding and a life really fully lived with looking at those subjects. You see it also in that little book I did, The Love Icebox, where these are just mostly love letters to Merce. He's seducing this person that he's falling in love with. But even in that, when he's talking about his own awakenings to certain kinds of things happening in music, it's all so thoughtful, and it's all in this continuum of actual knowledge. It's not like, well, how am I going to get them? How am I going to wow them? How am I going to get them to pay attention to me ever?
No, and while I think there is a point in Cage's life when I think he does decide that he's going to be an important composer. I think he does decide that, And I think he also recognizes that there is an opportunity for that to be the case. I mean, that this is not unique to Cage. The point at which composers start saving their letters
Right.
is also the point at which they kind of go, oh, actually, someone might want to read these. And I think there is a point where he decides that, but equally, and I think he's probably wanted that for a long time as well. You see these sorts of failed attempts to get a publisher at various points in the 1950s when he obviously feels that that's an important part of what it means to be doing the thing that he's doing. But that, I mean, just like the other stuff, is held in tension with the fact that the reason for doing that is to make the work. It's it,
Because,
it's not it's not self-serving. It's yes, I need to be an important composer, and yes, I'm interested in doing that, but there is still the sort of honorable cause behind that, which is because I believe profoundly in making the things that I'm making.
right, and believing profoundly in the ideas that are behind those things, and he's
Absolutely.
really wanting people to not reject them, but to understand what they're doing by engaging with his work, what the possibilities are. And it really bothered him when he felt that that was overlooked, that
Yeah.
people didn't dig in and find themselves in the same dilemmas that he found himself and how to get out of those things. I don't know, it was all very loving. I just remember my experience of him. It was never to reject anyone. It was never to put himself before anyone. Just the opposite, actually. But going back, so you actually started your engagement. I'm a little confused by the two books, the Darmstadt book, which, by the way, in many ways is my favorite because it's so it almost is like a detective novel because you're building toward this shock, this person who's going to be coming in, and you really do that very beautifully without getting all excited about it. You keep interlacing that, this would be taking place, this would be happening, and in he walks, and indeed it was shocking for the whole thing, and it kind of came brought the house of not the house of cards, but brought the structure down in a way. But anyway, I forgot where I was going with this. Martin, oh, all I was going to say is that the Darmstadt book and the David Tudor book were both obviously published by Cambridge University Press. But they were published the same year. Does that mean that you had them?
They were published a month apart,
I
in
know, but
fact.
so did that mean that you had them under your arm and said, I have these two books?
So I was originally writing the what became the Darmstadt book, and that's what took me to the States to go and look at the Tudor materials at the Getty in LA and to look at the Cage materials at Northwestern. And I hadn't really thought of a correspondence volume particularly at the time. That wasn't that this was just I was just going to read these things and look at materials with a mind to writing a history of the 1950s at Darmstadt. And it simply struck me that at a certain point it turned out that I'd typed out all of Cage's letters to Tudor, and I'd typed out all of Tudor's letters to Cage. And no one had published them, and they were great, or I thought they were great and really interesting, and told me all sorts of things I would never have imagined. And I love about them the things that I always love about all of these correspondents, which frustrates me as an academic, which is that they never tell me the things I really want to, or they very rarely tell me the things that I want to. There's so little talk about matters of technicality. There are a couple of letters in there where there are really teaching letters, but largely this is correspondence between friends about things that talk around the stuff that that I think I want to do. And in the reading of it, I realize that this is what I want to read anyway. And the reality of that book, and the reason why it's half correspondence and half an account of what Tudor does to perform things, is again quite a banal one, in that I didn't think there were enough letters really to get anyone to publish a whole book, and I thought, well, what can I do alongside this? Actually, I mean, of course, there's great work that preceded me, not especially by James Pritchett and John Hultsatful, on what Tudor had done, and writing those things is inconceivable without it. But inevitably, both of them had concentrated on individual pieces, and so it does all look like an opportunity to kind of build on what they'd done and sort of walk the reader through Tudor's progress as a realizer of Cage's work. And so the whole book, in all sorts of ways, is, I mean, I guess opportunistic in the sense of I literally saw an opportunity and thought, oh, well, this looks like an exciting thing, and I've got all the stuff.
And you also know that where you were heading was not available to you.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. And it was also, this would be a really useful thing to be in the world, I think. So they, I mean, they saw they did sort of run in parallel, I think, as I remember it. I can't exactly remember the sequence of it, but yeah, they certainly weren't intended to get published within a month of one another. But that's just how it ultimately ended up coming out. I mean, it's nice. I like those sorts
No,
of
it's very
odd
nice.
coincidences.
Frankly, I was trying to envision how this happened. And I saw you going into the office of Cambridge University Press and selling them on the idea of, oh, let's say the Tudor book with the other one under your arm, manuscript. Yeah. Now, I already have one done, but I want to do this one, but maybe you'll take a look at this one. So you contracted these two books independent of each other.
Yeah, and
Obviously,
I think
prior to that year.
if I remember rightly, the Tudor one was contracted much earlier because I more or less had to have the whole manuscript for the Darmstadt one, I think, before it got contracted. I think that's right. And the Tudor one was contracted on the basis of like the first third or something like that, which also makes sense. I mean, the book follows essentially the same pattern.
It also, it's interesting. Interesting is not even the right word, but the mere fact that the Nantes, the Boulez Cage letters, was put out by Cambridge in the same series, I find that fascinating. That was a good, what was that, 20 years? Was it? No,
Yeah,
fifteen years or so, 14 years, 91. Oh yeah, no, 20 years. Yeah. So there was. It's like they were setting a stage somehow for your work. In an interesting way, because you really do. I know this is part of the blurb on the back of your book, but it's so right, that you really think about the Boulez Cage letters, you think about the David Tudor letters, you think about the now Peter Yates letters, which actually predate all of it, which is funny that that came last, but that they all come from the same publisher, and there's quite a bit of distance between them.
Yeah, and I suppose that's true. I mean, part of this is, I mean, I did my doctorate at Cambridge, and simply as a result of that, that's the first publisher that I spoke to. I didn't even really think about the Nattier at the time, except that that book had been a really important one for me as a younger musicologist, and probably not though even the model for those books. I mean, actually, the model for those books is, and I forget who the editor is, which is shameful of me really, but was above all a beautiful set of the letters between Ingeborg Bachmann and Paul Celan, which I read and just thought, this is wonderfully edited. I mean, I'm pretty sure there's an English translation now as well, and that it's glorious and wonderful and heartbreaking. I mean, of course, two better writers of prose, and well, two better writers of poetry and prose would be harder to imagine. So oddly, that I think that was more the model for how the books turned out, as a way of just going, this is the thing that I'm really engaged with as a reader. But yeah, the Nattier was certainly really, really important, as actually probably was were some of his other musicological writings. So yeah, I think that's, again, it's sort of a set of chances, but it's lovely, I think, to be able to kind of go,
Totally, totally,
it, you've
totally.
got you've got the trilogy.
Yeah, no, I feel exactly that way, and I loved that the blurb on the back of the book said that, that we now have this trilogy. And I remember when I did, I guess it was, I must have still been in school because of Peter Yates, because I was at, I did my dissertation at UCLA, so Los Angeles had its own little coterie of Cage base, And Peter Yates was an early correspondent with Cage. And I remember thinking that much later, like when the Tudor book comes out, I think, isn't it interesting how Cage evolves? And as he evolves, a lot of it's that evolution comes out of these correspondences with very key people. It's not everybody, not most of the letters are learned or shaping him. the way that, say, those letters with Peter Yates did, or the letters with David Tudor, of course, in part because of who those people were, but also because Cage befriended them, became attached to them, whatever, when he did.
Yeah, and I think the letters with Yeats are in, I mean, of obvious and particular importance because Yeats knew Cage before he was Cage.
Exactly.
And you have those fascinating bits that rub up wonderfully uncomfortably with those established histories, like the point at which Yeats casually says, "Of course he was then a Stravinsky man." And you think, what? Really? And then, of course, I mean, it plays out, and it makes perfect sense. And I do hypothesize in the start of that actually the square root technique is arguably better derived from Stravinsky than it is from Satie, although you can find it in Satie too.
Or
And
Schoenberg.
oh, sure, I mean, it's true. There are versions of it of there, and of course, then you have the intimate knowledge that Yeats has of Cage when he's a Schoenberg student. And it's just all of these things that end up passing into myth were, and even with the fallibility of memory, were everyday occurrences for
Exactly,
this
exactly.
correspondent.
And you learn that
Yeah.
through those delightful exchanges between these two people who couldn't really have been more different, in a
Yeah,
way.
absolutely.
Yeah.
And there is also that. You, I mean, you, there's very clearly a point in that correspondence when Yeats moves from being the senior member of the pair to the more junior, or at any rate to and one of the things I mean I always loved about that correspondence, the thing again that I think made me really want to spend time with it was the fact that relatively early on, even though Cage does push back, Yeats was about the only person I ever saw telling Cage he was wrong, and Cage taking it and thinking about it, rather than thinking about it through debate,
Right.
which he does
No, I think
elsewhere.
that's true. I think that's true. And it was such a beautiful thing that in your own work, you, Martin, stumble upon Yeats and say, what else is there in this collection? What else is, available at, whereas you see SD, right? San Diego
Yeah.
is in the Mandeville collection, that you just off you went to see what else there was. It is this delightful friendship that begins, as you say, not as equals. It's really Cage was the goofy composer. Yeats was really more with arts and architecture at that point. Anyway, they both learned so much from each other, and you see that unfolding across that correspondence.
But I mean, it's also true, of course, that Yeats is one of the first people who really sees something in Cage. And unambiguously, I mean, maybe not way before anybody else, but before most people, gets a sense of who Cage is and who he's going to be as well.
I believe that. I believe that to be the case. And I also believe that Yeats, who I never met, my parents are Angelenos. I'm originally from that part of the world. All I was going to say is that, Yeates was a figure in Los Angeles history. And I think that may have given him a little insight into who Cage was, or how he differed from the atmosphere in which he grew up. And what that said about him. Here was this person who knew he was different, but it didn't know how that related to other worlds because he was a Los Angeles boy.
And I think that's absolutely true. And there is this. I mean, I'm crassly oversimplifying, but I think there is a sense in so much of the writing, because Cage becomes so much a New Yorker in so many ways, that the Angelino Cage, which I think is profoundly important to him as an individual, gets forgotten a little bit. And yeah, I do want to try to center that importance, and Yeats is also really, really useful for that in some ways, because on one level, Yeats is a blow-in to Los Angeles. He's a
Exactly,
Canadian,
exactly, exactly.
but he's also a Dodgers fan, so
Yes, an original Dodgers fan.
that's true.
So Tudor, moving so forward but backwards. in terms of your books, the Eights being the last book. Well, you did the serialism book, which I still don't have, so I can't actually wait to get that. This is his latest book. This is Martin did another book in 2023, also with Cambridge, right? Or is that all?
Yeah.
No, it is with Cambridge.
It's Cambridge.
It's so oh, that's right. It's so titled. It's the Cambridge Book of Serialism.
Cambridge Companion to Serialism. I mean,
Yes.
that's an edited book, but the hard work in there is done by many others than me.
Yeah, I see. Okay, fine. It just has your name on it. But I'm always interested in people who challenge, not challenge, but who put forward the idea that Cage's Chance was just another branch of serialism. And it's arguable. I mean, one could look at it that way. It seems to me to be so much more philosophically based than serialism, which is much more procedurally based. However, do you know what I mean?
I mean, I think it depends on the sort of when and the where and how exactly you're going to cut it, as because on the I remember the conversation in developing the companion, precisely. I mean, gently provocative as a question, but nonetheless want to be taken seriously as to why Cage doesn't feature. And in some ways, I sympathize because if you go and look at those pieces from the 1950s. If your understanding of serialism, and I would regard this as a perfectly reasonable mainstream understanding of serialism, is that its real characteristic, its primary principal characteristic, is that you treat musical parameters independently and then you later recombine those treatments. Then there is no question at all that for most of Cage's music in the 1950s, he is quite as rigorously a serial composer, arguably more rigorous. For most of that decade, than as composers like Boulez and Stockhausen, and so on that level, I've no problem at all with agreeing with the Cage is the most serial composer of all of them. There are, of course, really, really stark differences,
Of course.
and that I think is largely that the procedures that most of the European composers undertook were designed to give answers. And Cage's version of this was designed to frame questions.
Exactly. No, I think that's a really nice way to put it. Anyway, we got off a little bit there. But but going back to Tudor is where I was heading with you, that the Tudor book, it is wonderful. There were a lot of people digging around Tudor at the time that you did that book. I mean, John Holzapfel, of course, being one of them, and his book came out kind of around the same time yours did.
The one on the concert, that was a bit later. It took quite a while for John to get
Yeah,
that out.
he was working for years. You know who else we keep waiting for is Mark Swede. I mean, talk about, Cage as the Angelino. Mark is supremely positioned to do that book. He worked under Martin Bertheimer. Bertheimer? Yeah, that sounds funny. Anyway, but Tudor is a different case, isn't he? Because talk about the kind of senior junior relationship. Cage had taken sort of David Tudor under his wing at some point, bringing him into the Cunningham fold. It really. If Cage had any bone to pick with David, it had to do with that David did not have a publisher and didn't give this any thought, And Cage said, "You have to have a publisher." And that was Cage, the person looking out for his longevity, looking out for his how he would be seen at some point, how his work would endure. He thought that David was setting himself up for kind of ephemerality, if you will. And I think that's sort of true. It's happened with David, although David had more lives than Cage had, if you know what I mean. He had life as a concert pianist. I mean, he was a brilliant pianist. He then had a life as a composer, of these kind of open works that he did, these kind of the work with the Cunningham Company, all of those. That was new what he did, and it fought against the idea of published score as much as it didn't, I'm supposed to say. Anyway.
I mean, in that sense, it has been remarkable over the past 10, 20 years to see that enormous resurgence in the interest in Tudor as a composer,
I agree.
and the understanding of how to maintain those works. I mean, Unakai, who I mean wrote this wonderful book about Tudor's electronic music, quite rightly takes me to task for saying that the archival trail runs cold in terms of thinking about how Tudor works on things round about 1961, 1962, precisely because, quite rightly, I naively wasn't thinking about technology as a score at the time. And
Exactly.
as soon as you know, as soon as you says that, you think, well, of course it is, of course. And so it's really exciting to see the ways in which younger scholars, younger composers have really taken on this thing and turned it into something that continues to live, but lives in a very, very different way from the ways in which scores do.
Yes, I think that's true. You know, I think if you think about it, Cage lived into a time when he was, I call it kind of presaging technology. He was writing these pieces. I'm actually writing a piece about this now, but he was writing music at a time when there was a part of him, I believe, way in the back of his head that understood where we were heading in terms of technology. And he was writing works that were going to be fulfillable via that means at some point. Where David, for whatever reason, you know, David only lived 4 more years after Cage died. I mean, it was, they died very close and almost the same ages, right? How old was David when he died?
I would have to look it up. I can't.
75, 76, something like that. I don't think he was even 80, and Cage wasn't either. But David sort of lived in that. He lived in the technology. He lived for it in a way. You know, you look at the, we have all there at the John Cage Trust, we inherited all of the road boxes that the musicians used when they went out on tour with the Cunningham Company. All of the stuff, you know, there are piles and piles of now obsolete tape machines and cords and adapters and all this stuff. David lived in that stuff. And when Cage wanted to dabble in some way with it, it was David who helped him. So they were very different. So Cage's advice to Tudor may have been, it came from the heart, but I think in some way he didn't, he wasn't Tudor. You know, he wasn't this person who lived well aware of what the technology could and couldn't do. He somehow had this dream space about it, Cage did. That's the only
I
way
mean,
I
I think that makes sense in all sorts of ways, though. When you live this technology, when it's your everyday, then it's much harder to envisage all the ways in which you might break it or change it or do it entirely differently. Because in order for it to be the everyday, you have to have that sort of intimate understanding.
Yes, and there's a sort of practicality about it. It's, you know, where John would dream up something and say, David, how would I, you know, do something? And David would figure that out and then move on to the next question.
Whereas, I mean, I think Cage was also highly practical, but the practicality is more of a sort of given this these means and this thing, what can be done?
No, I agree. I agree. It's interesting, you know, that he presaged so much of it and he's still doing that for me. You know, I've been doing this job a really long time and just now stepping down, yay me. But 32 years I've been doing this and I can honestly say that, you know, not a week goes by that I don't come across something that I didn't know before about Cage just through accident, you know, looking at a score and say, how is it that I didn't even know that this piece really existed, what this was, you know, which played with just some tiny little idea and then he was off and running in some other direction. But there's, you know, he was like that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's in some way the same impulse. I'm remembering you were talking about, frankly, the sheer number of footnotes that appear in, for instance, the Yeats book. I mean, it's the same sort of impulse that drives that as well. There are so many little things in letters. Again, you've dealt with this in the letters volume more broadly across a vast range of different correspondence, where you think, because you don't have the context, and because these are not letters often intended for publication, these are letters between friends. There's a lingua franca that develops in that. We think, what on earth does that mean?
Right. There are still things that puzzle me about the select letters, where he says something and I just don't, it's clearly a reference to something, but it's long gone. Like we're never going to understand, it's probably a layered reference.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the what I think for anyone who spends time with correspondence, there has to be a sort of joy in the working out of what on earth this thing is.
Yes, that you all of a sudden say, oh, aha,
Yeah.
of course.
Exactly. I see what this means. And the again the joy and the challenge and I suppose I sort of ask readers' forbearance on this is that once you start down that path, it's like, no, I'm gonna try and explain everything I can.
No matter how silly it might seem, and you might be right, you might be right.
I mean, in some ways, I think that kind of that is a Cajun impulse. I mean, that is also one of the things that I continue to take from him, which is the reason for doing that is you set up a parameter, and the parameter is I want to explain everything I can,
Right.
and I'm going to follow that through rigorously. And I think when you look at Cage's working procedure, so much of it is okay. So at this point, I make a decision about what the piece is. And now I follow that decision through really, really rigorously.
Right.
And part of the joy of that sometimes also is that you might look at the decision and go, I think the decision seems like a really bad decision.
Right.
But guess what? When you follow it through with real rigor and care and love and attention, it turns out it wasn't a bad decision at all.
That's right. That's right. The other thing that you have in the Cajun Tutor book that you're not dealing with in the other books, although in a different way, I suppose you are. You could argue this with me that in the Tutor in the Cage book, you have this very real phenomenon of this being a really important relationship for both of these people. That Cage really needed David Tutor, and he needed David Tutor on his side. Meaning that he would perform his works and do them so well. He needed David to understand him. And frankly, Cage was fell in love with David Tudor early on. That was clear. And David Tudor really needed that relationship with Cage. He wanted to be allied with Cage. It was invigorating for him because nobody really understood how what an incredibly interesting mind David Tudor had, except for Cage, So you have, it's a little walking on ice, these two people, because Cage didn't want to overwhelm David. Sometimes he did. And David didn't want to push too hard away because he didn't want Cage to leave. You know what I mean? I feel that tension between them through kind of everything, where that's not there with Yeats, that he was, strongly with, I was going to say, well, I don't know. I don't know what I was going to say, but it's different. The relationship with Tudor is in some ways way more complicated than certainly than Yeats, where Yeats was the senior. When did Yeats die? Do you know?
Yeats died in 1973, I want to say, maybe
Early.
76.
Early.
It's sometime in the 70s, but it's long before. But again, he is older.
Yeah. I don't remember Cage writing about that, about Yeats's death. He may not, they may not have had, how long is the correspondence?
I mean, it goes through from the 30s up to quite close to his death. Quite late on, he's trying to get Cage to come to Buffalo.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And
That's
it
right.
doesn't quite work out. Although you get I mean, Feldman's there, so
Yeah. He
it's
ultimately did,
close.
but do you have a favorite of the three books that we've talked about? Your Darmstadt book, the Tudor book, and now the Yeats book. Is there a favorite for you?
I mean, one hesitates to speak about any of these things as being an important book, but
But they're like your children. They're your children.
but I
You don't
think the
want to say,
Darmstadt
I
book
like the oldest, the elder child.
No, I think the Darmstadt book is the one that it matters most is in the world. I think that's that 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 you know if you're asking me to kind of point to a legacy book. which I'm not
No,
50.
I guess I'm
I'm
then.
not thinking of legacies, but that's the one that I've kind of go that seems to have done stuff. The Tudor book I love because of what I learned in doing it. It's uneven. It doesn't it, it 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 I don't think the structure quite holds, and it was fun to try it, and the interlacing it doesn't quite hang together, and I quite like the fact that it doesn't hang together now with a bit of distance. Also, there are several absolute mistakes in it that I still don't know how are there because I thought I corrected them. Anyway, there are things in it that I kind of go, well, I'm glad I did it. There's lots of useful stuff in there. I really do love the Yeats book. I mean, in part because of the desire to go in and bat for lost causes slightly, and I think I care about the correspondence between Cage and Peter Yeats in a way that probably no one else would have done, though I'm convinced it's really of profound importance for Cage and for Yeats alike. So if I had to save one of them from a fire, I might save the Yeats book.
Okay, fine. I love all three, frankly. And the Darmstadt book, I have to say, was for me, it was many revelations as I read the Darmstadt book. It's like, wow, I never thought about it that way, or I never knew that, or you know.
I mean, the one thing that I think isn't quite right in the Darmstadt book with regard to Cage, I think is my later realization of quite how close Cage and the European avant-garde felt themselves to be on a composerly level at that moment. And yeah, I absolutely I think that this must be a sort of confected or constructed shock in some respects. I do suggest that because there isn't a unity to be broken apart in the first place. So it does sort of happen on the discursive level. And I think it's even stronger that understanding that really this is about what people think is going on, about the construction of what people think. And that's new music administrators, journalists,
Interesting, interesting.
think is happening more than what's going on for the composers. And I think that torsion between the two is actually really, really interesting. That the distinction between the level of discourse, what people write about new music and what it feels like from the inside, and the ways in which those two worlds find it very difficult to talk to one another, a thing which I think probably continues to be true.
I think it's a really important book. Your Darmstadt book. I think they're all important. I mean, for as really the way you just laid it all out, I feel exactly the same way as an outsider about the three books. But I think that the Darmstadt book, in terms of the being on the shelf, it is the book that I would turn to for understanding about a certain period of time in a kind of full way, as opposed to Cage and Yeats, who are really learning together, they're growing up together. Young Cage is a pleasure to work with, isn't he? You know, he's so genuinely quizzical, I guess is the way I would put it, that he really sees himself. He's yearning to be somebody as he grows and wanting to put the right foot forward, but he never is untrue to himself in doing that, I don't think.
No, there's that lovely thing that I think you realize that Cage basically does not lie. I mean, maybe he does, but basically he doesn't. Basically, Cage tells you the absolute truth. It's just that sometimes he says it in such an idiosyncratic way that it's very difficult to understand the thing that he means. And I think that is also sort of at its zenith in the 1950s, where he's also at the same time trying to work out how he's supposed to say these things.
I think
And
that's true. He paid very much attention to that. He was
yeah.
very cognizant of that. And something I found myself over the years saying to a couple of people who I really, really enjoyed their talking and their writings, and I would see them on a panel and I would say, you only do one thing wrong, and that is you should stop before you answer a question. Just give it a minute. Just give it a minute. There was this one person, I'm not naming names, but there was this one person who just, did that, but mostly jabbered. While inside, he was working on an answer to the question. Cage never did that. If anything, he chewed on the inside of his cheek while he was thinking. He looked like he was mulling over his cud or something.
It's exactly the same advice I give to doctoral students before they go on and do their Viva exams.
It's just
Don't feel you have to answer the question immediately.
that's right. You tell them they look actually smarter if they don't, you
Yeah,
know.
take a moment, think about it. Make sure you're answering the question that was actually asked.
Yes, and don't feel like anybody's judging you if you take a little too long to do that because nobody cares.
And, I mean, also, I've spent enough time with Cage to take pleasure in an uncomfortable silence.
Right. Good for you. Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, Martin. I would love another revelation that I had with you this morning was listening to some of your music, which I've never taken the time to do. I'm embarrassed to say. And I'm happy to be able to tell our listeners that there's a great deal of your music that's available to listen to on his website, martinidden.com. Is there anything that you would recommend? And by the way, if we have time available at the end of this program, I'd love to play some of your music. Is there anything there that you would recommend, A or B, that I can download or you want to, can you provide?
Yeah, I can do that. I think probably the best thing to do is off the most recent CD, which simply because you can stream the whole thing on Bandcamp.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see what how much time we have left
Sure.
once I edit. But it's been a pleasure. I love your work and I have loved your work from afar for a really long time. So it's kind of like a little dream come true to talk with you today.
That's lovely. Thanks so much. It means a lot.
Great, great. We'll talk again.
I'll look forward to it.
Okay, have a good
Keep
weekend.
well. You too. Ciao, ciao.
Bye. Before closing this week's program, let's listen to a bit of music by composer Martin Idden, specifically an excerpt from his Hesperides from 2022, performed by the Quiet Music Ensemble QME, for whom it was composed. It was recently released on NMC Recordings as NMC-D295. Other included works on this CD are In L from 2012 and Lampadas, Torchbearers from 2020. This last written for Jack Adler McKean, the featured tuba player. Before we begin, though, a note from Idden on the recording itself. This music is meant to be very quiet, and listening to it at the right volume makes a significant difference. Try to set your volume so that the loudest moments are full and present, but not actually loud. This might make the quietest moments barely audible, on the edge of what you can hear, which is about right. If you're listening somewhere where there's a bit of noise, some of the louder sounds around you may even be a bit louder than the quietest sounds on the recording. That's as it should be. Now on to an excerpt from Martin Idden's Hesperides from 2022. Enjoy.